Hi, I am Tali Bauman, a junior at Stern College for Women. Thank you for joining us here today. At this time, I would like to ask everyone to please turn off all cell phones and hold all questions until the end of the lecture. We encourage you to use the pages in the back of your conference booklet to take notes. Organ donation has become an important and relevant topic in the Jewish community as medical science and technology has developed and advanced over the past few decades. As members of the Jewish community, it is imperative that we understand the medical and halachic issues of organ donation. Dr. Stuart Greenstein will be speaking about live and deceased organ donation from a halachic and medical perspective. Dr. Greenstein is a professor of surgery and an attending surgeon at Montefiore Medical Center, Albert Einstein College of Medicine. As an accomplished transplant surgeon and member of the Bioethics Committee at Montefiore Medical Center, Dr. Greenstein has become an expert on organ donation and transplantation and serves as an esteemed resource for the Orthodox community. We are honored to have Dr. Greenstein speak to us today. Please welcome Dr. Greenstein.
Thank you, Ms. Hell. Well, first of all, it's very hard to follow after Rabbi Tendler because he really just makes a point and that's it. I mean, we can go home. He addressed an issue that I am not going to be discussing. That's donation after cardiac death, because I think that that's more for the rabbinical person to really get into more than the transplant surgeon. It is done. I can tell you from my own point of view, I'm involved only after the organs are taken out, which is the right way of doing it for a transplant surgeon, and that is that the organs are taken out and then they're put in. So therefore, I don't have to deal with the halachic issue of donation after cardiac death. So what I want to do today, actually, is talk about organ donation, an update overview, and the Jewish law. And first of all, the disclaimer, unlike Eddie Reichman, I don't have smicha, but I've learned a lot from Eddie and from the other rabbanim, so I think I know a fair amount. But again, the only time of the year that I do get smicha is 2 days of the year. Right before Yom Kippur and right before Tisha B'Av, all my patients call me to ask me whether or not they're allowed to fast. And they actually, all the rabbis tell them, call Dr. Greenstein, because we defer to his opinion about your fasting. So 2 days a year I get smicha, but the rest of the time, I'm just, Doogie Howser, I guess. Anyway, okay. Let's see. So, first of all, a little bit about the stats and why we have this, why we're having this talk. As of September 1st, 2008, there were almost 100,000 patients waiting for an organ in the United States that were registered through UNOS. UNOS is the United Network for Organ Sharing. It's a centralized organization that deals with all the organs and in terms of procurement, cadaver donation, and also in terms of giving them to the actual organizations, and also in terms of the follow-up. Of those 100,000, 76,000 approximately are waiting for a kidney. If you go on the website, UNOS.org, you will see the number increase every second of every day almost, except on weekends where we don't have the programs open. But during weekdays, it's every second. It keeps going up. There are approximately 816 children waiting for a kidney transplant in the United States. A child is defined as anybody who's less than 18 years of age. So I just lost that 2 years ago because I'm only 20. But anyway, so that's a lot of kids. And transplants for kids are very important, especially for kidney, because when you have kidney failure as a child, you don't grow physically, mentally, emotionally. If you remember, there's a TV show, Different Strokes. I forgot the actor's name. Right, Gary Coleman. Thanks. Thanks, Alex. He's had a transplant 5 times. He's very, very short. It's the ravages of having kidney failure. It affects your bone growth and... That's what you see. So transplantation for children are very, very critical for them to keep on growing in all aspects. 4,500 patients a year die waiting for a kidney transplant, those that are being registered on the waiting list. And that number keeps on going up. About many, many more in terms of transplants, of patients waiting for transplants die waiting for heart and liver, by the way. Kidney transplant patients, when they don't get transplanted, they stay on dialysis. So they have a way of staying alive. So therefore, the issue for a kidney patient versus a liver patient and a heart patient is much different, because in some ways, for a kidney patient, you may say that's not pikuach nefesh for them to get transplanted because they can stay alive. Whereas for a heart or liver patient, if they don't get that organ, they will die in a very, very short period of time. I can tell you I've had that discussion about the whole issue of pikuach nefesh for a kidney transplantation with Rabbanim, because I am I'm machmer in many, many things. And for instance, one of the medicines that's used for kidney transplantation is cyclosporine. And it comes either in liquid form or in a gel capsule. So many, many years ago, I said to one of the Rabbanim, I said that the patients who are frum can only take the liquid formulation. Why? Because the... Something not working? Because the capsule formulation, the capsule itself is made from pure pig gelatin, which they get from Germany, which is then transported to Switzerland where they make the drug. And I said, you can therefore not have to take that. You take the kosher formulation, which is the liquid formulation. The rabbi said to me, nope, you're wrong. I'm also machmer on pikuach nefesh, and I'm machmer on everything in terms of life. And if it's easier for the patient to take the liquid formulation, if it's easier for him to take the capsule formulation, they should take the capsule formulation. And the other point that he made was, in terms of kidney transplants, even though you may not die today, but if you don't get a transplant, if your life is shortened because you have kidney failure, then it's still considered pikuach nefesh. So with that, let's go a little bit about how we do transplants. There are two ways we can do a transplant in this day and age, either from a live donor or a deceased donor. In the old days, the deceased donor was called a cadaveric donor. It's felt to be not the right term anymore, so we call them deceased donors. In terms of living donors, and I think we should discuss live donation, even though most of the program today is talking about end-of-life issues, we should discuss living donors because it also has an end-of-life issue for that recipient. If they can't get an organ from a deceased donor, but they could get from a living donor, you can prevent that end of life for them. Organs donated from living donors include blood, bone marrow, kidney, liver, lung, actually pancreas and small bowel can also be added onto the slide. So many, many organs can be donated from live donors. Now, I'd like to discuss with you guys three cases and see what you would really think from an ethical point of view. This is the living donor case. There was this child who had a transplant. He got his first kidney from his father. And then after 2 years, Renata, who lived as a healthy girl for the first time in her life, would start skipping her medicines. Compliance is a very, very important issue in transplantation. So her kidney from her father began to fail. Now she needs another kidney. Her mother was ineligible to donate, but her father, who's 38, wants to give his daughter the one kidney that he has remaining. In other words, he wants to take what he has, his one kidney, give it to his daughter, even though he already gave his first kidney and she lost it, and that's a separate issue about compliance. He wants to take that remaining kidney of his, donate to his daughter, and doesn't care about the fact that he's going to go on to dialysis. He's going to have kidney failure. That's a major ethical issue. I can tell you, excuse me one second. I can tell you that... From my perspective, you can't do that. You can't sacrifice one life for another, and that's what you're doing here, totally. But it was an ethical issue. Can you take from somebody that you know by doing this it's going to harm them and give it to another person as a live donation? Now, let me throw in this other case, just to think, because there are cases that we have to deal with. I had a 79-year-old person came to me from Florida because they did not want to transplant him down in Florida. His 57-year-old daughter wanted to give him a kidney. He's 79, she's 57. The 57-year-old daughter was a senior vice president of a major, major corporation in the United States. So she was clearly well-educated about everything. The father had been on dialysis for 2 years, and after 2 years said, I can't live this way. Okay, I will take your kidney. Realizing that the family had, even 2 years earlier, been willing to give them had been willing to donate. So what do you do? 79-year-old, how many more years of life does he have? You might say, right? From his 57-year-old daughter, is that really right? Now, the 57-year-old daughter was perfectly healthy, by the way. No reason why she shouldn't donate. From an ethical point of view, should we take from the 57-year-old, give to the 79-year-old? I had the 79-year-old recipient, and this is 3 years ago, by the way, cleared by our cardiologist. And the cardiologist said to me, wait a minute. You want me to clear this person, but it's wrong. Why should you be doing this transplant? My response back to him, by the way, was that I didn't ask for an ethics consult. I asked for a cardiology consult. You just tell me whether or not this person's well enough. I will, in our group, and we didn't go to bioethics in this case, in our group made the decision that it was the right thing. He's already 3.5 years out of his transplant, by the way, and he's doing great. He's having the time of his life. His daughter has done fine. But what would you do in that case? Because that's an extreme. So you have two extreme cases. One that's going to put you on dialysis. One that you're giving to somebody that may not have all the years that you would think they should have if they were younger. Okay. Well, the first basic point that you have to think about live donation is, why should it be, do we have any halakha point to make us want to do this? So, in Vayechi Perek Yutes, it says, Lo samod adam recha. You're not supposed to stand idly if you know that your brother's blood is being shed. You got to save your brother, whatever you can. You can't stand back and say, it's okay. But to what extreme are you supposed to go? The 57-year-old daughter, should she give to the 79-year-old? Or the father, can he give a second kidney? This is clearly a wonderful example for that case. Well, the Shulchan Aruch Kosher Mishpat even deals with this in a different way. They try to elaborate what's the point. So, Haraz Chavera Tova Bayam. You see your friend drowning in the sea. Oh, listen, Bayam Allah. Or you see there were some robbers coming upon him. What are you supposed to do? Oh, Chaya Rabba. Or you see an animal, a wild animal, coming after this guy. And you can't help him. What are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to do it, or are you supposed to hire somebody else to do it? If you don't, whether you hire or you do it yourself, so here the Shulchan Aruch clearly says, makes some elaborate points about what we're supposed to do. And this can be elaborated to live donation. You see somebody needing to be helped, and you know it's not going to hurt you. You should go ahead and do it. So this is basic points for why live donation would be permissible. And if you don't, and you stand idly, you have a love from the Torah. The Gemara in Sanhedrin also deals with this. It says, this is the same kind of case. So it says that. That's where we learn that you can't stand idly. But then it goes on and says, but we learn from here. We learn from this other place. That if you have a Hashavas Aveda, you lose something, it's incumbent upon us to return to our neighbor their lost item, correct? Losing life is the same concept. So here the Gemara says, if you see that person is going to lose their life, that's how you learn you're supposed to not stand idly. You're supposed to help them. So Tam Loma Vahashavas Lo, you're supposed to return to him. So Ima Hasam Habe Amina Hani Mile Ben Asher, if we had learned from this case, We were only in your nefesh, only with your own life you're supposed to help that person to return. So this Gemara says that the reason why we learn from Lo Samot Da'adam Recha, because you want to understand, it's not just your own nefesh that you're supposed to do, your own goof, your own body, help that person. But if other things are required, whether you have to pay somebody else to help them to save their life, you know, to have somebody jump into the water, you can't swim, but you have an extra neighbor. You say, no, I'll pay you to jump in and help that person, save him. You're supposed to do that. So we see we have certain points. The Ravaz here, by the way, I'm not going to read this one for you, but he set certain parameters for the risk and performance of the mitzvah. He said that you should even go to the extreme that if the sultan says to you, cut your arm off, or I'm going to kill your friend, you're supposed to cut your arm off. So we see that you're supposed to put yourself at some risk. In those days, cutting your arm off was already a point where if you cut your arm off, you could still live. So he's saying that you can do that. So you can put yourself at some risk for live donation. The Sisse Eliezer also deals with this in terms of how much we can go by it. And I don't want to go over every point, but there are many, many sources that deal with it. Now, the final point was that in the past, they say you can't do live donation. And I've actually heard Rabbi Tenley say that way, way in the past. With it being so successful in terms of not only for the recipient but also for the donor, most Rabbanim will tell you that it's permissible. Organ donation for a kidney right now, I'm going to talk about kidney only for a moment, is permissible to the point where we have now many, many areas of the United States and especially in the New York area, organizations that are rising and coming forward to try and promote organ donation in an altruistic fashion. There's an organization called Renewal that does this, and they've done a wonderful job where people come to them saying, I need the transplant. They screen them very, very carefully. If that organization finds that you have a donor and a relative and you're not willing to take it, they won't help you to find some altruistic donor. Other organizations that do that now also is HOSE, Halakhic Organ Donor Society. So there are places out there that are trying to promote live donation in a halakhic basis. In any event, so now it's not currently the case, and surely and certainly it's a mitzvah to donate in order to save another person from certain death. Now, kidney donation risk is very, very small. The risk for donation, this is probably the stuff that I think Eddie wants me to talk about, and that's the medical aspects also, it's 0.03%. 3 out of 10,000 donors die if they donate an organ. That's very, very small. It used to be I would tell people that the risk of walking the streets of New York were greater, but then Giuliani became mayor, so it became very, very safe. In any event, so the risk is very, very small. Complication rate is very, very small. Donors are screened very, very carefully, the live donors, when they were kidney donors, for all the medical issues. And only after they pass through all these tests are they then allowed to donate. What's going on now, though, because the number of recipients it keeps on growing tremendously, transplant programs are expanding what they will and won't use in terms of living donors. And so it's going to be important over the next 10 years to see what really will be the story. But be it as it may, for the most part, if you go to a transplant program, you can be rest assured that live donation is a safe procedure as a kidney donor. Liver, some people will tell you, is different. The risk for liver is much greater. And when I say much greater, I don't mean 10%, 20% of liver recipients die. No. It's probably, if it's 0.03% for a kidney, it's 3% for a liver. So it's a magnitude of 100, 1,000 times more. But 3% is still 3%, but it's still very small, but in some people's mind, it's a lot. So you have to be careful when you want to think about live donation for liver. You have to really understand the basic points about what goes on and what are the risks. Let me just go on from this. Again, this was really just to show you that with altruistic donation coming forward, people started putting ads in, and this was an ad actually of the first one I ever did. This was placed in the Coalition newspaper in April 2002. The recipient had gotten, it was a fascinating story. He put an ad in the Jewish press, and people came forward. A husband and wife came forward to donate. And they both came forward and went through the whole testing. The husband I ruled out, so the wife gave. It turned out that this gentleman who received the kidney went to the same shul as the husband and wife, was very, very close friends with the husband and wife. Up until the point when they came in to be tested, they didn't know that their friend needed a kidney transplant. In fact, the husband was part and him were the same chavrusa. They learned every day. So in some ways, everything was kept very, very secretive until people started coming forward. And that's what is being done now. More and more people are doing that. You'll see ads in Jewish press, Hamodia, where people are advertising right now, please help this person, save my husband, a good father, grandfather. And you see this constantly. And like I said, now there's an organization called Renewal that is doing this on a daily basis. Since December, I've actually done 10 transplants in the Orthodox community with donors being found by Renewal. One of them was a 24-year-old girl who came from Israel to give to her 10-year-old boy from Borough Park. Another one was a donor who is a very leading figure in Eish HaTorah who came forward, and she's been promoting now through Eish HaTorah live donation. So live donation is very, very feasible. It's doable. And you have to understand that most poskim will tell you that it's a mitzvah to do a live donation. This final slide on that really is Kloyos Yotzos. It's the phrase from in Gemara Brachos, which is most important organ. And in my point of view, the kidney is clearly the most important organ. I'm a kidney transplant surgeon. This was a pill pool from Beis Din in Yerushalayim. One of the members of the Knesset, Rabbi Rabitz, many, many years ago, came to me for a second opinion. He needed a transplant. He wanted to know whether or not he should take a kidney from his children. And we went through everything, and I said, yes. He went back to Eretz-Yisrael, and then the fun started. What was the fun? All of his boys came forward and said, I want to donate. Who do you take from? His youngest son was the first one to say, I'm going to give a kidney to you, Dad. So he said, I came forward first. I should have the schus. The oldest brother said, No. I'm the oldest brother. I have kibud of aim. That's the mitzvah that first comes upon me. I should have first dibs. I should be able to give. So what do? So in classic fashion in Judaism, what do? We go to Bezdin, we have a pilpul, and we decide. This is an actual sefer. And it's a fascinating sefer, not only from a transplant point of view, but just in terms of all the halakhas of kibud av and all these other aspects. And I recommend it very highly. It's about yay thick, not that bad to read. It's all in Hebrew, which I'm sure you guys can do very easily. So I would recommend it very to be read. Now let's switch gears, and now let's talk about deceased donation, which I think is more attuned to end-of-life issues. In this picture, you see what we can do. We can take a lot of different structures from a deceased donor and transplant them. Let's start with the face, number one, blood vessels, number two, lungs, three, heart, four, liver, six, kidneys, 10, 11 is pancreas, 12 is small bowel. Then you have 8 and 7 are bones and nerves, 9 again are blood vessels. So a lot of different things that can be taken. What's missing here also, actually, skin is number 2. That's what it is. And cornea, I guess, would be number 1, although cornea could also be face transplants now. So a lot of different organs from deceased donors. Once we decide that deceased donation is permissible halakhically, and I will say this, I'm not a rav, I am not here to proselytize you to make you think that deceased donation is permissible, although I do think it is based upon brain death criteria. So I will say this, I am in Rabbi Tendler's camp. I know there are two camps here. There's Rabbi Bleich camp and Rabbi Tendler camp. I'll leave it to you guys to decide which camp you want to be in camped in, but I'll let you know which camp I am right now. So, first of all, Lo Samor Adam Recha does not apply for deceased donation. Because once you're dead, you don't have any of the mitzvos, the lavs, also, you don't have any of the aseis, the losa stays on you. So that issue, that's why living donation is important to understand, because the losa mode does not come forward as a reason why deceased donation should be permissible. What do we know about deceased donation? Or what do we know about laws about deceased people? We have on panas an obligation to bury the body. The kavura is the mitzvah. There are also prohibitions against us, against the desecrating, deriving benefit. So an hanas mace, a nivol mace, those are clearly issues for us. We're not allowed to do things that would give us hanah from them, and we're not allowed to desecrate the body. But the overriding rule that wipes these away is pikuach nefesh. Before pikuach nefesh, we can violate all these laws. Now, you have to realize that back in the 18th and 19th centuries, they had fears of premature burials. And this is just an art piece that shows that somebody's trying to get out of the coffin. The fear was so great that in the 1800s, they tried to do things to try to show that people who were dead stayed dead, and people who weren't dead had the ability to rise up from the dead, so to speak. So the for whom the bell tolls, that phrase really revolves around this whole thing where you have a coffin. Inside the coffin is a string which is hooked up to the outside to a bell. If the person within 3 days suddenly is resurrected and is alive, he would pull the bell and they would know, oh, get him out of there, he's alive. So that was the whole basis of for whom the bell tolls in terms of trying to capitalize on the fear of the people weren't really dead. They were to the point that they made legislation that required all those who were diagnosed as dead to be kept alive, kept above ground for 3 days until putrefaction begins. Now that creates a problem from halacha, because we know from a halacha basis you're supposed to bury them right away. But this is what was done. And in fact, the question was, if you had somebody who was a Kohen and a doctor in those days, and they had to go and declare the person dead, what were they supposed to do? Well, because there's a suffix of whether or not the person might be alive, they said in this tshuva that they're supposed to go, and it's permissible for the Kohen to go in, even though the person may be dead or maybe as in the form of maybe just a ghost face. So, with that, let's really switch gears a little bit and talk about how do we define brain death. Because the whole basis of organ donation is based upon brain death. Now, brain death definition came out in the late 60s. Harvard had a conference on definition of brain death, and that was in 1968. So if you want to really go to the sources, so to speak, go back to New England Journal, which describes the whole brain death conference. Anyway, what is brain death? You have to first understand the brain. We have the cerebrum, cerebellum, and then we have the brainstem. The brainstem, I don't have a pointer, but
is this? Cerebellum, cerebrum.
It's important to recognize these structures because you can have people who are not brain dead, but act like they are, in the sense of they have what's called a persistent vegetative state. So, Schiavo, Karen Quillen, those are patients who are in persistent vegetative states. They were not brain dead. How do you define brain death? They have to have brainstem death. If you have brainstem death, then you have brain death. Brain death is not defined by cerebellum or cerebrum death. So, if you have no cerebral function or cerebral function, you cannot be defined as brain death. You may be just in a major coma, persistent vegetative state. And you have to realize that because kids will come by and they'll joke, hey, Dad, bad news, you're brain dead. Well, clearly this little kid doesn't know how to define it because the father's sitting up and probably communicating with him. But this is, you know, what we see sometimes. How do you define brain death? First of all, there are bedside testings that we do. We have to have, and I apologize for the slide, doesn't come across that well, but as you can see here, there are many, many things that are done to define brain death. Most important things is they are examined neurologically, and if they have corneal reflexes or anything like that, or if they breathe spontaneously on their own, they can't be brain dead. Because those kind of reflexes, spontaneous respiration, comes from the brainstem. But let's say they pass the clinical, these bedside testings, and they're still not sure whether or not a person is brain dead. Then you do confirmatory imaging. You could do an angiogram, which shows blood flow through the brain, an EEG, and if an EEG is flat, then you're brain dead. You can do a transcranial Doppler and other tests. You can do a scan of the brain. So what would that look like? Well, if you've given somebody a brain scan and you can't find anything, they still might not be brain dead because maybe they don't have a brain. I mean, my kids have told me that all the time. But this is really what we're talking about when we say that somebody's brain dead. The top slide shows normal carotid arterial angiography, where you see blood flow to the brain. And the bottom one shows there isn't. It stops. Doesn't go. There's no blood flow to the brainstem. Stops right there. This is a PET scan. Again, you see imaging where you see activity in the brain. And then on the right-hand side, you see brain death. There's no imaging. There's no blood flow. So if there's no blood flow to the brain, starting from the brainstem up, you're brain dead. What can mimic brain death? And this is very, very important. And this is where the controversy comes out, where, you know, you'll have some rebuttal saying somebody's not brain dead. Well, you're right. They're not brain dead. They're persistent vegetative state. We're not saying they're brain dead. The only time you can have brain death is if you have brainstem death. If you have cerebral death, that's not brain death. So a person like Schiavo had a locked-in syndrome. They had cerebellar death. Most of the cerebellum, cerebrum was dead, so therefore they had no cognitive function. A person who's hypothermic can look like they're brain dead. So you cannot define somebody to be brain dead if they're cold. So somebody falls into a swimming pool, really cold water, and is underwater for a while. They may look like they're brain dead, but if you give them time and warm them up, you will start seeing EEG function. Drug intoxication is the same thing. Somebody who's intoxicated with certain drugs will be thought to be brain dead. Once they come out of their intoxication, they'll see function. So there are ways to distinguish between brain death and those that are not brain dead. This was the Schiavo tombstone. And if you notice what they said, she was born in 63, departed in 90, and at peace in 2005. Because from 1990 on to 2005, she was in a persistent vegetative state. She was not brain dead. So by the classic definition, she would not have been an organ donor. This is the kind of person, though, that the family could come forward and say, we want to do donation after cardiac death. Because the heart kept on beating and beating and beating. It was the brain that was not functioning. So in terms of all sources for brain death that allow us to come forward and say, okay, we can take the organs from this deceased donor, there will be several sources I'm going to try to go through right now. First, it talks about Mishnah in Olo, where it talks about Tumah. If you take a lizard, you cut off the tail of the head of the lizard, the tail of the lizard keeps on going on. It has pirichas. That's considered still death, even though there's activity. So motion does not make somebody to be alive. All right? In the Gemara Yoma, it says, if somebody has a building fall on top of them, all right, it's on Shabbos, clearly you have the mitzvah to try and save their life. So how far are you supposed to go to try and save their life until you finally realize they're dead? So this is what the Gemara was talking about. It says, Tana Rabbanan Hechen Hu Bodek, so until, up to what point are you supposed to investigate? Ad Chotmo, until the nose. V'yeshem Rim Ad Libo, there are some who say the heart. So this is the controversy. Breathing versus cardiac. Aval Inu Pekuach Nefesh Afila Abba Shom. Sorry. Moda Diyaka Chayasa Be'al Pe'ahu. So even Abba Shom says the most important things relate to the head. So, this is the basis for the controversy about whether or not we can decide and call somebody brain dead based upon chodmo, and the chodmo, by the way, the nose really is extrapolated to really respiration. And this is the basis for where Rabbi Tendler will tell you that he heard his father, Moshe Feinstein, talk about brain death, and that brain death is defined by respiratory death, and respiratory death is defined by brainstem, because that's where you get spontaneous bleeding. Sorry. I'm going to skip the Chatam so far. I want to get into the discussion about the major positions today. So you have, first of all, Reb Moshe and Reb Tendler. The small print one was Reb Moshe's letter from Igros Moshe. But essentially, what Reb Moshe and Feinstein will tell you that is respiration is determined. The current brainstem criteria are sufficient to determine the absence of independent respiration. And this is the whole basis for what Reb Tendler was talking about in there about brainstem, brain death versus cardiac death. Respiratory death, if you have somebody who has a positive apnea test, then they are, and they have confirmatory tests, then you are brain dead. Now, probably from a halachic point of view, what's important is that what's going on right now is that you will find that the rabbanim who say it's okay to be an organ donor will tell you that you should, first of all, if there is a family member that you are suspicious of that is brain death, you should ask your rabbi. And that's the first step. Have your rabbi involved. And if they have questions, they will kick it up to a higher level that's involved in an organization like Rabbi Tendler. That's how the whole thing came about with Eliza Fleitau, who in 96 was killed in a terrorist attack in Israel. Her father, Steve Fleitau, was a very, very good friend of mine, had to go to Israel, saw his daughter there lying with just a simple wound in the back of her head, which penetrated her brainstem and caused her to be dead. He didn't know what to do. He called up Rabbi Tendler. They discussed it, and based upon this tshuva of Reb Moshe, he said it's okay to donate the organs. The chief rabbinate actually goes along with this, but let's go to the controversy part. So Rav Schachter, he will tell you circulation is determined. There are three averim, shenashama tulei bahem, that's the heart, liver, and brain. So what does he say finally? He says it's a suffix if cessation of circulation to one or all is required to determine death. So he's telling you that, okay, maybe respiration, you're right. But what the suffix is, we don't know if you have to have cessation to everything. And if that's the case, everything would mean also cardiac. So that's where he's actually in the middle of the road between Bleich and Rabbi Tendler. Rabbi Bleich clearly is on the other campus and will tell you, although he's on this campus, he will tell you that there's no such thing as brain death, and that's clear-cut murder. And there's no doubt about it. He does not believe in brain death as for organ donation. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he accepts the principle of brain death. What he then says, though, is, and to every rabbinical statement, there's always a caveat of a disclaimer. He says, but the brain death patient is a suffix gosis. And what's the problem is that all current forms of testing to determine brain death violate the prohibition of moving a gosis and therefore cannot be performed. And if you can't test them, you can't determine that they're clearly brain death, and therefore you're locked in of not being able to donate. So that's where it would come from, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And the final controversial point was recently there was something that came out saying that there's no such thing as brain death, and this was written in tradition. And of course, Eddie pulled the plug on brain death by saying, you're not right. And that discussion really involved, well, whether or not there was blood flow to the hypothalamus. If there's blood flow through the hypothalamus, you can't be brain dead. We all agree. It's below that in the brainstem. If there's no blood flow and the brainstem is dead, then you're dead. So that was Eddie's point back. So there are a lot of sources for deceased organ donation that you could read and come with and then decide for your own whether you want to say it's permissible or not. Rabbi Tendler asked me to specifically say that there is no doubt that organ donation is permissible using brain death criteria. So I've said it. I've carried forth what he wanted me to say. With brain death, and again, we're just talking about brain death. There are a lot of other organs that I said you can do transplants for. Recently, in the last couple of years, they did a face transplant, hand transplants you've heard of, larynx transplant, give people back their voices. And now, in fact, in the New York area, I'm part of the New York Organ Donor Network, and there's a research protocol from one of the hospitals that they want to do uterus transplants, to transplant from a deceased donor the uterus to somebody who has lost their uterus for whatever reason. So there are a lot of possibilities of helping people through organ donation. What you have to realize is that the good news is your body didn't reject the organ transplant. The bad news is the bank rejected your check. And that's what we have to worry about, because it's a big business right now, transplantation. And a lot of what's going on is to try to increase organ donation. And what's going on with that, I'll just spend 2 minutes on that, is that you'll find that in organ donation, deceased donation based upon brain death is accepted by most. Now we've gone to donation after cardiac death, which is a very, very controversial subject, especially from a Jewish point of view. In most people's minds, there's no point of view. It's absolutely not permissible. But there are those who might say it is. Then we go into, well, should we then take organs from donors that are higher risk for recipients? So you have that ethical point of view. So there are a lot of problems that are coming forward in donation because we don't have enough donations, because there are all these recipients growing on the list. How we're going to handle that? Don't have an answer. We'll see. Anyway, questions? And if I'm more than happy to answer questions now. Yep. Well, that, given that, you might say that clearly liver donation is permissible. I mean, there is any operation you do on any patient has with it a risk. There's nothing, no such thing as zero risk. So, you know, when you tell a patient, first of all, there's a risk of dying from a donation for the kidney of 3 out of 10,000, what that patient has to realize is if he's that one patient, it's 100% for him. So the same thing's true for a liver patient. You know, the risk is greater. They have to realize that. They have to accept that. Here, because the risk is still small, 3% or 0.03%, people would tell you that from a halachic point of view, it's permissible. Where the risk of doing something would tell you that you can't is when you know you can't swim and you see your friend drowning. You know that if you jump in, you're going to drown. You're not allowed to do that then, from a halachic point of view. So therefore, in that case, you wouldn't have to donate, or you wouldn't have to, I'm sorry, jump in. But if you know that you can swim, but, you know, the water's cold, but you don't want to do that, then that's something different. So the Radvaz is giving you a certain kind of limit of what you can and cannot do. Where it's a definite, you know, you have to realize, can, by donating a kidney, can you have some kind of injury to the person? Sure, you only have one kidney. You might say, that's an injury. Turns out, by only having one kidney, the remaining kidney picks up the slack, and you can go on to have a normal, healthy life. With the liver, when you take a part of the liver as a living donor, the remaining liver grows back to that size of the liver. So actually, livers do better than kidneys. You don't regenerate a kidney, you regenerate a liver. You just have to get through the operation. Alex?
So in the room, I'm the least educated. Question may seem naive and obvious.
Okay.
In Jewish law, is there consideration for the place that decisions made within communities of Jews have in a broader society of non-Jews?
Yes.
And therefore, what would be the discussion that would arise after a criticism of the relative ease of receiving a live kidney that happens within a tight-knit Jewish community because of those connections and the, say, the unfair opportunity that presents to people within that community compared to others who are just as sick outside?
All right. The answer to that, I'll tell you, is that Rabbi Steinmetz, who's the organizer of that organization, Renewal, will tell you that, will give you this as an answer. And I guess your question is, okay, I'm going to paraphrase the question, make sure I understand it. You have this Orthodox person who says, I'm going to give the kidney to that person, the Hasidic boy over there, versus why should he give it to this Spanish person from Spanish Harlem?
Who's sicker.
Okay. The answer that he would give you is that, and you have to understand the viewpoint of Judaism to a certain degree. And by the way, we're talking about live donation, not cadaver donation.
I'm talking about
just live donation.
Okay,
this, because the seed donation is a different answer, and they wouldn't hold back. Live donation, if you have, I'll ask you the question, you have your brother who needs an organ, and his friend also needs an organ. Who do you normally give first to? You give to your own brother. So the answer here is, I have this young man who is considered my brother, all right, versus somebody else who's not. So we give to our own brethren first. Now, this does not preclude, I have to tell you, that this organization, Renewal, that works to this effect, does not prevent other groups doing the same thing. In fact, I'm in the process of working on developing a Spanish Renewal with the same flavor, where you try to get within your community to promote life donation to help within, because there's no reason why you shouldn't. There are people who have come forward for Renewal, for instance, who are willing to give to other people even on the list. It's, you know, everybody has their own different viewpoint, but about what they will or will not do. In terms of deceased donation, by the way, you cannot say, I want it to go to that person. So that is known. You have to get to that first step from an Orthodox point of view of getting them to donate. And once they say they're willing to donate, then it goes wherever it goes in terms of cadaver deceased donation. Right, via UNOS. That's correct. But, you know, it's, instead of looking at it on a negative way, I think we should look at it in a positive way of how community-wise we try to help ourselves. And every community does this in different ways. I mean, where I live in Teaneck, there's an organization that helps people right now because of the way the economy's gone. We each are helping out other people in our community in terms of financially, whether it's health insurance, mortgage payments, things like that. If each community does that, the sum total still is the whole world helping itself. Are you saying take that organ, grow it in a plate versus definitely transplant it?
Yes. Well, not definitely. Again, it might work, it might not.
Well, you won't. I don't think you would take out an organ from anybody if you didn't think it was going to work. So if it's not going to go into this another person and it's not going to work, you won't take it out. I mean, the premise is in any operation I do that it's going to work. So I'm not sure if I understand your question, but if you're choosing between taking it out and working in one person versus taking out and growing it up and maybe growing up many, many organs, theoretically, I think that it's up to the technology in terms of where we are. If we're at the point in technology that we are able to all grow up these organs with a 99% certainty, I think that you could make the point to say, let's go after that rather than, you know, go for the many, you know, the needs of many outweigh the needs of one, as Spock said in one of the Star Treks. So you go after the many. it depends where technology is. I don't think you can give a hard, you know, definite answer on that one. Right now, we don't have the technology to do that. So definitely, you take out, you know, if a person wants to come forward, donate an organ, a kidney, to somebody else, go for it, assuming that they are healthy and they are put through a very rigorous workup. You know, not everybody should be a donor. Okay, cornea. Okay, well, first of all, cornea is very simple because there it's. You are definitely saving. Now, I'm going to ask you this: you're not saving a person's life when you do a cornea transplant. But the answer is you are, because being blind is like being dead. So if you then give somebody back their sight, then you are giving them back life. So we can put that away. That therefore, cornea transplant is a viable transplant. It's permissible. I mean, that's probably the easiest thing from a halakha point of view to do. Face transplants, it's very, very experimental. I don't know, I honestly can't answer you that, whether the halakha would say that you're allowed to take the face of a deceased donor. Because you have to realize, in all of this, you still don't want to desecrate the dead. So you got to get into that issue. I don't know, I'm not sure what the Rabbanim would say about that. I really don't know. My own opinion? I don't have an opinion on that. I haven't thought about it long enough. I think that rather not say. Okay. You had a question, Avital? In terms of deceased donation or living donation? I think, I will tell you, I think that Rabbi Tendler had mentioned the term slippery slope. I agree with him. We are in many ways on a slippery slope, not only transplant, but in other fields of medicine. And the slope is increasing dramatically. I think we have to be very, very careful. I mean, you look at what happened 2 years ago. There was a donor in California. It was a deceased donor who was not brain dead, who was donation after cardiac death. The transplant surgeon was actually in the operating room involved in the donation process, which is a major no-no. You cannot be. It's a total conflict of interest. You cannot be there. You're not supposed to be there. And he had made comments like, oh, give some more candy to accelerate, you know, to make him die, so to speak. Candy being morphine to just suppress his respiration, things like that, to speed it along. That guy probably is going to go to jail because he definitely was on a major slippery slope, major lawsuit. You have other cases. I mean, in a different way, from a deceased donor point of view, what do you tell the recipient? Right now, you know, they take out organs from people who... their lifestyle is a little bit, shall we say, in repute. And, you know, they'll do testing on them and they'll say, oh, the HIV is negative, even though just yesterday they were using IV drugs. Do you use those organs? And what do you tell the recipients? So you have to be very careful in what's going on in transplantation. There was an article just recently in New England Journal, a sounding board, just like the other thing that Robert Tanner showed, about how do we consent recipients and what do we tell them and things like that, which we probably will be bringing up in our own bioethics. I sent it to Nancy. It's a major slippery slope. What's driving that is that medicine, for those who want to go into medicine, should recognize that medicine is a business. It's not medicine anymore. I don't know, Alex, would you agree with me about that? Alex and I are both on the same bioethics committee.
Not entirely.
Okay. I'm sorry?
I agree with you in part.
Okay. We usually agree in part. So we're there again. But I think that, you know, there's a slippery slope out there. Definitely is. Any other questions? Yes. No, it's not. I don't think it is. What part of Canada? Where are you from? Okay.
then they're in a consistent vegetative state. So it would be...
That's a very tough call. Well,
right.
Now from the non-halakhic point of view, right, that person probably would become a donor very quickly and give to that family member. I mean, I thought you were going to go differently. We had somebody who was supposed to be a live donor to his brother and then was killed in a car accident and became a live deceased donor. Gave to his brother, actually, his kidney, but he was deceased. So that is the next phase of what if they're not totally deceased, so to speak, they're locked in. Depends who you're going to ask right now, right? If you ask Robert Tenley, he would tell you it's murder. Right, you know, that's. But I think again, I won't give you my own point of view of that. But I'll tell you what I'm sure Rabbi Tendler will tell you. He will tell you it's murder. Donation after cardiac death, from a halakhic point of view, is considered murder because you are. There's a difference between being actively involved in death and passively involved in death. You're actively doing something to cause the death of that person, so that's why. I mean, just take out one kidney. Well, that's a different issue. I actually asked that same kind of question to Avram Avram when he gave a lecture many, many years ago at Maimonides. That, okay, you don't believe in brain death. Fine. I tell you I have this person who's brain dead. You don't want to let me take his organs out the regular. Can I take out only one kidney? And one kidney, by only taking out one kidney, theoretically, I'm not causing his death. He wouldn't answer the question. You're going to get into other issues because if you don't believe in brain death, then you can't do that either for one reason. That person is a gosis. You're not supposed to touch the person as a gosis. So it becomes complicated. So either you have to believe somewhat about brain death or they won't let you take even that single organ. But you're right. It's an interesting case. What would you do? Halakhically, if it's both organs, they're going to say no, according to Robert Tendler. If it's one organ, I'd be curious to see what he said. Okay. Thank you.